Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guest. In this case, it's Jeff Callen, someone I've known for a really long time. And in fact, I think I met you when you were working with Norman Lear on all sorts of legal issues concerning All in the Family and the pioneering.
You did a huge series for the Los Angeles Times.
That's right. Yeah. I interviewed you, I interviewed Warren Nolney, and it was all about what's going to happen to television, what's going to happen to media. And at the time, you were teaching at UCLA, and then you went on to become head of Voice of America, and then you came back and you were the dean of the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC, and you've written a number of very important books, one on Clarence Darrow, the great lawyer and defender of civil liberties, and one on Teddy Roosevelt, the great trust buster, most recently. And the reason I want to talk to you is obviously because Donald Trump is president, and people are scratching their heads all over the world what to make of this. And you were, under Bill Clinton, you were head of the most important outlet that America has from a governmental point of view to the world, the Voice of America.
So the Voice of America was established during World War II to combat Nazi propaganda. It was started in 1942. And as you know, the first director for the first year was John Houseman, the great director, later actor and writer, and the second director was my father. But from the beginning, the concept was that Nazi propaganda would distort the truth and that the Voice of America was committed to the truth. So in the first broadcast, they said, the news may be good, the news may be bad, we'll always tell you the truth. And that was the concept of the Voice of America, that you could, that ultimately whatever problems there were in the United States, that if we were a truth-telling institution, we would ultimately share, people in the world would be more attracted to us, they'd learn about our values, and they would consider the United States a place where they wanted to immigrate, that they wanted to have trade with, that they'd be more sympathetic if there were institutions where there might be conflicts. And so it was a very exciting place to run. And when I ran it, we had 53 language services with a listenership of about 100 million people around the world. And we were mainly on radio, but also in those early days, we were also on satellite broadcasting and TV. So the Voice of America was a really important institution, and it had a charter that said that it was a requirement that you be accurate, that you be balanced, and that you be comprehensive. And before I got there, during the Nixon administration, there had been efforts to get the Voice of America not to report on the impeachment proceedings against and all the Watergate stories. And the then head of the Voice of America, who had been appointed by Republicans, said, no, our job is to tell the truth. That's what we do. And that signature, that notion, has always been what the Voice of America has stood for. So under the right circumstances, the Voice of America remains an incredibly important institution in the world. Unlike radio or Russian television, which is more designed to have certain propagandistic purposes, the Voice of America's concept was that the best propaganda is to tell the truth.
Good. But now you have a president who might not be fully committed to that idea.
Right.
And actually, we're at a moment. I mean, the reason I wanted to do this interview with you is you've been observing this stuff forever, politics and life. You've taught it. You've been an administrator. You've been a writer. Did you ever think you'd come to this moment? Is this the scariest moment of your...
Well, Bob, it's a topic that it's interesting for us to discuss. It's scary enough without having to say it's the scariest. So, I mean, I'm totally with you on it being scary. I don't know what it would have felt like, you know, on the eve of the Civil War or when you're
okay.
in the Civil War.
Fair enough. But let me cut to the chase here. We have really, we're living at a time now where truth, accuracy, fact, logic, all seem to be called into question. And I'm not saying any one group had, I think all, you know, I.F. Stone famously said all governments lie, and certainly all politicians do, and they shade the truth and so forth. But we seem to be in a situation now where the whole standard of debate, argumentation, has been challenged.
Well, at this moment, the Trump administration, and we're here 10 days in, we're, you know, freezing the frame at this moment. But right now, the press is considered the enemy, the opposition party. And that's a serious problem, I think, for the press, serious problem for the president. But, Bob, you've been a great journalist for so long, and I'm sure your listeners all know that. Sheer intelligence has been, you know, your sheer intelligence has been so many things for so many years. But in a certain sense, the press that you've been part of has been an opposition press all the time, even though it didn't structure itself that way. It told the truth. But if it was an unpleasant truth, you'd do it. And if the facts that were coming from the government weren't facts, you'd challenge them. And I think that leaders of all kinds are furious and upset about the press. I don't remember ever seeing before, but it's possible there have been times when the government has been so determined to make the press the enemy. And to me, the real question is, what powers do they try to bring to bear to try to not only try to delegitimize the press, but to actually attack them with whatever legal powers they have? For example, during the campaign, Trump said that he didn't really believe in the protections of libel laws. By the same token, by the way, he shouldn't be protected, and neither should his people who make an awful lot of mistakes, let's say. But I think we're in a very challenging time right now.
Yeah, it's challenging, but it seems to me, and you're quite a student of American history, and we know we've never been able to take freedom for granted. It's something you've had to fight for and defend and struggle. You've been very active with groups like the American Civil Liberties Union, which seems more vital than ever.
I mean, what a great, just to stop for 1 second, Bob, and again, as we're sitting here today, when this executive order was signed by the president, and it prohibited people from coming in from 7 countries, which are Muslim-majority countries. And it looked like it was going after refugees, looks like it is, in a most serious way. And the ACLU took them to court. The ACLU, which, if I have these facts right, normally raises about $4 million a year in direct mail and so forth, over one weekend raised $20 million.
Right. And I gather the head of Lyft gave $500,000 of that in support, as opposed to the head of Uber.
Uber's committed $3 million.
Oh, it has now.
It has.
Oh,
okay. But their $3 million isn't to the ACLU, but it's to support their drivers who they feel are under attack. Starbucks has committed to hire 10,000 immigrants. I mean, the corporate America element in this is very exciting to watch right now, but the most exciting is to watch people in the streets.
Yeah, but the real issue here, and it's interesting, you mentioned the founders and these protections we have, and one of the difficult things for anybody really to understand about the American experiment is that this absolute right to free press, free speech, to assemble, was put in place by people who were going to be the new government. It isn't, you know, it was something that they learned from their study of what had happened to England, what had happened to Rome, that we needed these protections. It wasn't in the first version, although we had separation of powers and checks and balances, which are now going to come into play. And we saw with a few judges who actually said, right, no, this is a usurpation of power. But I have this quote. I don't know why it's not more famous. I bring it up every time I can from George Washington's farewell address. And I remember when I first stumbled on it, I thought, that's not true. He couldn't have said that. And then I went and looked at the original copies of the original documents and everything. And in his farewell, he warned his fellow citizens to beware the impostures of pretended patriotism. And he warned them that, again, as Jefferson and Madison and others had warned about foreign entanglements, of foreign intrigues. And what you have now is once again a president invoking foreign danger, the enemy at the gate. And the idea that somehow freedom is a luxury, it's something you can only have in very stable times when you have no enemies. But that, and you're a lawyer by training, but you're also a constitutional scholar and professor, university professor at USC, former dean in the School of Journalism and Communication. And the interesting thing about the American experiment, these protections were put in a country that couldn't have been more at risk.
Yeah, this was something I think is fascinating, Bob. So often people say, oh, well, they couldn't imagine how dangerous things would be. How dangerous was this country that had just, you know, won a war with the most powerful country in the world? It was still a small, struggling country, which had what we now call Native Americans, they didn't then call them, at every side, which had people who had been on the side of the Brits against the revolution, all of them as threats to them. And so it was a very scary time, but they decided, you're absolutely right, that it was vital to protect freedom of speech and also that the government should fund the press. Not just that there ought to be a free press, but that in various ways the government funded the free press.
Most importantly, the Postal Service.
Particularly the Postal Service.
Yeah. And so the interesting thing, though, because this comes up, every generation has to be educated to this notion that freedom makes you stronger rather than weaker. And the assumption of the demagogue, the people who want to live in freedom, always is, oh, that's all very well and good, but we can't afford it. But the principle that I think is the most brilliant thing to come out of the whole American experience is that freedom makes you stronger. Free debate, robust debate drives out error. And whether it's about how did 9/11 happen or who are terrorists or how do you meet that threat or does torture work or any of the things that need to be debated in any society, there's one camp that says we don't have time for the debate. We know the answer and we'll basically intimidate or lock up anyone who has a different point of view. And I don't think I'm being unfair to Donald Trump and I suggest that he doesn't seem to have much tolerance for the importance of debate and dissent. But he's not alone. Whistleblowers didn't do so well under Barack Obama.
That's right.
And very few governments anywhere in the world seem to really be tolerant of
dissent. Well, you're talking about debate, Bob, but you're also talking about an aggressive press. I mean, I think that, Madison said that crucial to the notion of an informed electorate was the means of inquiring the information. You have to have a press that digs into the truth and presents people with the truth. That's a crucial part of it too. So it's not just debate. You can't have a useful debate unless you know the facts. And the facts are uncovered by an aggressive press.
I should say, by the way, I reintroduce you as Jeff Cowan, who was at one point head of Voice of America. He's a university professor at USC, was the dean of the Annenberg School of Communication and Journalism there. And we're talking about how America, and I want to get back to that subject, how America deals with this image now of the American president, American politics, and you have a great deal of experience. But I do want to say something about governments always lying, because LBJ is a very good example. And there were a lot of good folks. Tom Johnson, who was my publisher at the LA Times, had been in that White House. Bill Moyers was the press secretary in that White House. And we know that the big lie about Vietnam, the really big lie, was that the justification for extending the war to Vietnam and preventing any serious move towards peace was something called the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution,
right,
which the Senate passed, and Fulbright said if he had known the facts, he would have never supported it. And the facts, which were kept from the American people for 20 years.
Right.
So it's not only Nixon who could end up keeping lies. And the fact is there was no second Gulf of Tonkin attack, the basis of this whole thing. We'd expanded the war. We've got millions of people killed after, on the basis that many people in government knew was false. Whether that included the people I mentioned before, I don't know. But certainly Lyndon Johnson, certainly Hubert Humphrey, and people.
Well, and then when it all came out in the Pentagon Papers, of course, and by that time Nixon's in power, he does everything he can to prevent the Pentagon Papers from being printed. And I guess the point you're making, Bob, which I totally agree with, is that this is always a fight. It's always the press has to fight to get the information out and to inform the public. And a lot of things you won't know until much later, but you get the information that you can. The question is whether this administration, we don't know yet, is going to be really tougher on the press. They're calling the press the enemy. So far, they haven't used the power of government to do it. But there's a piece today in The Atlantic by a man named Elliot Cohen, who was in the State Department under second President Bush. And he's become a big critic of this administration, of the Trump administration. And in it, he warns that once they understand the instruments of power that they have at their disposal, whether it's the FBI or whether it's the Internal Revenue Service, there's a risk that they will overuse those things. And he predicts, I'm not predicting this, but he predicts that there will be clashes that will ultimately lead to possibly even an impeachment of this president. But we don't know if this president will go that far. What you're saying, pointing out, is that pretty much every president has had this fight about the press disclosures, and it was true of Obama, too.
No, but it goes deeper than that. Once you're in this national security area, you can lie with impunity. That was Washington's warning about right. the impostures of pretended patriotism, because you're dealing with basically events outside of the country. People cannot observe it in an eyewitness term. Who bombed this? Who did that? Who so forth? For example, right now, Trump has banned people from certain Muslim countries. He pointedly excluded the main Muslim country that attacked the United States.
Well, the amazing thing is, if you read his executive order, it starts with some whereas clauses. And whereas we were bombed on 9/11, starts with that, and it was done by people from other countries. But then the people from those countries aren't on the list.
Right. They're not on the list.
And it may be a coincidence, probably not, that Trump has business interests in those countries.
Well, but that same hypocrisy existed before Trump. I mean, we have given Saudi Arabia a pass in many ways and blamed everybody.
When I ran The Voice of America, one of the challenges I faced, Bob, when I ran The Voice of America was, every year the State Department puts out a report on countries that are violating human rights. And Saudi Arabia was always pretty high on that list. And so the VOA would report about that report. And I insisted that we report on that report that Saudi Arabia was high on that list. And there were people in the government who didn't want us to report to it. But it's another example of we did it, because you had to do it in order to be credible.
Under the previous administration, there was always the idea, okay, we're blasting whistleblowers, and, you know, here's a president who's doing drone attack, President Obama, and here's a president operating in secrecy, and we still haven't... But it's okay, because the assumption is somehow the president will be a pretty good guy, and the president will observe limits. And what the warning we got from the founders of this country was, no, don't trust that. We will be the government, and you have to be suspicious of it. That was it. The guys who gave us, and they unfortunately were guys, the ones who gave us the whole notion of separation of powers and limit on powers, limited government, individual freedom, and so forth, were not talking about checking a foreign dictator. They were talking about checking themselves. The public would be checking them. We are going to be your government, and you better watch us with suspicion. Somehow, after 9/11, we lost all that.
Well, I don't know if we did lose it, Bob. I mean, I think it's, I think we've remained. I just think of one, Gwen Hulley was before 9/11, but we've had the exposure of the eavesdropping that the government was doing came out since 9/11, right? Pulitzer Prize-winning series by the New York Times. I mean, I think we continue to do it. I worry a little bit personally that the financial strength of these publications has eroded. I worry about social media leading people into cones where they aren't going to hear these things. I worry about the emergence of Fox News, which apparently I don't know this for sure, but let me not even assert this as a fact. I believe this to be true, that Fox News was not reporting on what was happening at the airports the other day. Now maybe they were, but CNN was. So you had the means of acquiring the information, but 40% of Trump's people got most of their news from Fox News. And Fox News has to be as vigilant with this president as they were with the last one.
Well, Jeff, hold on a second. It's time for us to take a break, and then we'll be right back to continue this discussion. I'm back with Jeff Cowan, and let's continue our discussion. And where we left it off is a point I don't want to lose here. Because the assumption always of people when their government, their guy, their party is in power is, okay, these things are not terrible. I mean, I wrote a whole book called They Know Everything About You in the Surveillance State. And the response of a lot of my friends, well, come on, it's not so terrible because Barack Obama is president and the Democrats are there and so forth. And the warning of our founders is just the good guys you have to worry about every bit as much as the bad guys, because the good guys you might be lulled into sleep. And the irony right now is, as your article that you mentioned by Cohen is true, is that we have an apparatus now that someone like Trump can use with impunity and you won't know it. All the spying, all the intimidating people, planting of data, the sort of thing that J. Edgar Hoover, under a Democratic president, did against Martin Luther King. Now, with modern technology, you can destroy anyone.
I mean, well, we may find some strange allies, Bob. I mean, there's an op-ed page piece in the papers today by somebody from the Cato Institute, being a libertarian institute, very critical of what this administration's doing. The Koch brothers, and I'm not going to try to make the case for the Koch brothers, but they issued a statement from the meeting that they just had with all their big donors attacking the ban on immigration. It'd be really interesting to see if these principled conservatives who were worried about big government would stand up and say it's just as bad when the big government happens to be in hands that call themselves Republicans.
You've been on the progressive side of the Democratic Party for a long time. And I'm asking you now to put on your thinking hat. I mean, we only have a few minutes left. But really, what happened to the Democratic Party? I mean, and in particular, this interest of class, the well-being of ordinary folks, the very thing Martin Luther King, when he died, said, don't forget that this even goes beyond race, it goes beyond everything. Don't forget the people collecting the garbage in Memphis.
But you and I talked the other day about the fact that for people of our age, it's kind of heartbreaking that the core of the Democratic Party, when I was growing up, were these working class people, and many of them were white working class people, and the rural people. Those are the people, the Franklin Roosevelt Democrats, the Harry Truman Democrats, that many of them were for JFK. And it turns out some of them were also for Obama, and many of them now have turned to be for Trump. And I think it's really important that we recapture them. When you think of it, Bill Clinton in 1992 ran a campaign.
Not recapture, serve,
well,
care
both,
about.
Both. Yeah. Well, I'm saying recapture by doing things that are the things they care about. And Bill Clinton's campaign theme in 92 was, it's the economy, stupid. And it was. And I'm not going to argue, Bob, about whether everything he did was right for that. Let me tell you one thing that I think has really damaged the Democratic Party. And you know, one of the causes of my life has been campaign finance reform. And the problems that have occurred is not just Citizens United, which is what we blame. But it's not – Citizens United did not allow candidates to go out and raise a lot more money. It allowed corporations to give money. But candidates, up until 2008, were allowed to get matching funds for the primaries, and all their money for the general election was paid for out of the federal treasury, out of money that people had as tax checkoffs. People have almost forgotten that. So 2000, 2004, that was the system. The result of that system was the people running for president didn't spend all their time raising money. Who broke that system?
Barack Obama. People should listen to that, because I when I bring it up, people look at me like I lost my marbles. But I supported Barack Obama, and I was dumbfounded by two things. One, he gave up public support of presidential campaign, and he quickly, after he had defeated Hillary Clinton in the primaries, turned to Wall Street and hired the very same people, Lawrence Summers,
Larry Summers
and others,
Summers especially,
who had engineered the great meltdown.
But I think one of the reasons that happens is that people raise all this money. And I don't think it's usually because they do favors for the people who they raise money from. I don't think it's as simple as that. To me, it's that you are, you know, Stokely Carmichael says this phrase where he said, you know, to people like me who were in the civil rights movement from New York, and compared to them, he said, you know, you wake up in the morning and you see Central Park and I see sharecroppers or something like that. It's who you're seeing every day. And the people that you see every day, when you have to raise $500 million, and by the way, Bernie Sanders did an amazing job of raising it through the web, really through the web. But the way in which Hillary Clinton raised the money and the way in which Barack Obama raised the money was that they had to spend all this time with in fundraisers with people who have a lot of money to give.
I know you because you've been my boss at USC. you were the dean, and when you came back from being head of Voice of America, you became the dean, and I actually had taken over one of your classes at UCLA when you went off, so we had a little connection.
And then I brought you to USC.
And now we're at USC, and where we both teach. And I just wonder, how did we miss the message about class in America? As educators, as journalists, if you look at the statistics, they're startling. Startling, the disappearance of the middle class, the, you know, what the labor unions had accomplished, and somehow we, you know, people looked the other way and didn't focus on it. As an educator, as a writer, as a book writer, and all these things, how did class get pushed aside? Was it the role of money in funding universities and funding papers?
I don't know if it was that, Bob. I mean, you know, we moved more away from class and toward what sometimes is called identity politics. You know, there's tremendous concern about people who come from more disadvantaged groups, as it's seen, from racially and disabilities and sexual preference, et cetera, all of which are very important themselves. But in the process of getting connected to those things, we seem to have lost the other. And when it seemed like all of those disfavored groups, all those people who needed to be helped, you were sort of forgetting the fact that that these other people needed to be helped too. And the pain that they have, you look at opiates, you know, opiate addiction in America is in counties that heavily voted for Trump. This is real pain. And the loss of manufacturing jobs, which I do not think is mainly due to trade, maybe that's part of it. I think it's largely due to automation. But it's real.
I just want to end on like sort of one issue, and that's torture. And to me, the most frightening thing about this bully president, that, you know, this demagogue, Donald Trump, and I, you know, I lose sleep over it, is that he says there's no space for transparency. And he takes a incredibly manipulative person who had been head of Breitbart and puts him in a key position on the National Security Council and so forth. And you've been inside government. And you know a lot of people who've been inside government. And we're talking about the most powerful government that's ever existed in the history of the world, a government that a president of the United States, who with very limited checks on him, could decide to destroy life on this planet. And my concern is, why, with all these years of preparation, we had one president who had Alzheimer's at the end, we had another president who was popping pills and drinking, Richard Nixon and so forth. How did we get to this place? You're a student of American history. How did we get to this place with all the warnings about limited government, where we now have a dangerous buffoon president who has actually no basic checks on his power when it comes to war and peace, life and death, torture, and all of those things? How did we get there?
I think these things take over a long period of time. I think the most interesting person to try to understand, Bob, and maybe the journalist in you will, is probably Steve Bannon, because I think he, unlike Trump, who may not think these things through much, I think Bannon is smart. I think he's a reader of history. I think he's a reader of literature. I think he has a view of what he's trying to do. I think much of what he's trying to do is very dangerous, but I think he has a view of it. And part of it is, I think, that he does believe that the working class has been screwed. And he thinks that, you know, he worked at Goldman Sachs. I think he has a perspective that's not a Goldman Sachs perspective. And so he thinks you can get to these people that way. The single most brilliant thing I think that Trump did, and it was when he reinstated the Keystone Pipeline, he said, but we're going to build the pipe in America. It was an incredible statement. Not a thing any of the Democrats would have thought about. That's a Breitbart, Steve Bannon type of statement. And I think that he's misguided in much of what he's trying to do, but he is focused on those people. And sadly, we've lost that focus, and maybe Bernie Sanders did have it, but we have to reestablish it. That's part of what has to happen to this during this sixth and seventh phases of political grief.
Yeah, but the sad note on that is when the populism comes from the right wing, they can focus on gaining the allegiance of ordinary folks. Mussolini did that. Hitler did that. You had the Volkswagen.
The labor unions liked what he had to say.
And he had the acquiescence of the big corporations. Mercedes and BMW went along, and so did the main church organizations, the Protestant and Catholic Church, the main ones. So the truly frightening thing is that freedom is only guaranteed to those who fight for it. And even though you've been in the center of power, it's good to hear that concern and that warning from Jeff Cowan. So thanks for doing this. This has been another edition of Sheer Intelligence. Our producers here at KCRW are Joshua Sheer and Rebecca Mooney. Kat Yor and Mario Diaz are our engineers. See you next week. Psychoma.